Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's March 27, 2016, and welcome to episode 123 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting, and chocolate. Hi guys, how are you?
Hey there, Michael. I'm good. How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good down here, Earl. And Paul, how are things in your end of the world?
Things are good here, too. Spring is arriving in this half of the world. Also, my computer's restarting in the background. That's nice.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, well, We're into autumn here, though the first week of autumn you wouldn't have known. It was some of the hot weather. But no, everything's nice here. Been getting out and about on the block. Had the jackhammer out yesterday, cutting into some stone to put down a concrete slab. You know, all the things you do out here in rural land.
Wow.
Dodge poisonous insects and things.
Oh, yes, yeah. Bitey insects and should be now starting to get too cool for the snakes to come out. But the spiders are there, the ticks are there. But there's plenty of fun creatures. Had some wallabies come through the yard. My wife saw an echidna stroll through the garden.
So wallabies are a real thing. They're not just like an Australian myth.
Oh, no, they're real. Just don't expect to see them in suburbia. It helps having a bush block. You know, most of my block is bush going down to a creek and backs onto a reserve. But we get the real wildlife here, so it's great. Best move I ever did getting out of the burbs.
Excellent.
Well, folks, enough of the wildlife in my end of the world. It's Easter, so we thought a good idea would be to just visit some Easter eggs for our classic computers. So, Earl, have you ever coded an Easter egg?
I have never coded anything that was technically an Easter egg, but when I left one workplace where I was the Novell administrator, or I think it was called supervisor in Novell, wasn't it? I coded something on the login script that every Monday would say, "I miss Earl." So that's about as close as I've ever done to actually putting in an Easter egg. I did make some software that was demo limited functionality once, but that doesn't count.
No, the closest I ever came to coding my own Easter egg is that back in my mainframe days, I had a morning login script that went through my calendar items and projects and things, and sent system messages back to the console so you could see what you had lined up for the day. And some other people liked it, so I set it up so it could be shared, and they could do their own calendar profiles. This was before we had work group software and whatnot. And so I decided that I just put a little bit of a test in there on the connecting user ID, and when it was my ID, the mainframe would greet me with a "Good morning, master," and for everyone else, it was "Hello, slave." But yeah, now that's the closest I've come to putting in there. Yeah, I've done my own programming style, so people know it's Michael's done the programming here. Normally it comes to the end of the main section. There'll be a game over, go get a coffee or something written in the comments just at the end there, but nothing that's sort of really hidden away that needs an archaic command or a game of Twister on the keyboard to bring up some hidden list. But it got me thinking, so I thought I'd find one of the earlier Easter eggs. So in 1960, as it says here on the internet, for the top 10 OS on a DEC PDP-10, you could call the basic editor with the make command. So if you typed make love, there would be a pause, and then it would say not war. So I suppose that technically is an Easter egg, because you have to put a specific command in and then it does something benign. Also interesting, a lot more interesting than a hidden developer list or something along those lines.
I think that counts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen that one. Sort of, it's just that kind of subtleness. And even the great Bill Gates managed to slip in some Easter eggs. One which I haven't seen, but I've seen lots of comments for, that is in the pet Microsoft Basic. If you type the command wait 6502, the screen will fill with uppercase Microsoft exclamation mark.
And rumor has it that Commodore was none too happy about that either.
Yes, it's challenging enough slipping an Easter egg past your own management, but when you are your own management, I suppose you've got other people's management to worry about. So I'm sure there was a tersely worded letter sent back to young Bill about that one.
The string Microsoft, I think Microsoft exclamation point appears somewhere in the AppleSoft ROM too, as well.
AppleSoft it does, yes.
It's I think it's reversed, and the last byte of that has a, I don't know what it is, like a high bit set or something like that. So you can, so it's a little bit hard to decode. You have to work a little bit to get it out of there, but you can find it.
Mm, and I believe it's in there so that it's like a footprint if someone just goes and lifts the ROM directly, with, rather than creating a compatible one themselves for the basic. But they normally put in things like that. Apple have done, they've done stolen from Apple and things along those lines. I'm sure lots of people have slipped in text strings into programs that aren't used, and things along those lines, footprint things, not technically Easter eggs, just little things hidden in there. So of the ones that I found interesting, I thought I'd just throw in a modern day one. So for all you listeners out there who use Firefox or Chrome, pop over to Google and do a search on the text, do a barrel roll. And I'm sure you'll enjoy that little Easter egg if you haven't seen it before. So, are there any other creative developer lists and other little Easter eggs that you guys have seen in the past? Is there anything out there for Commodores?
Well, there's that one that you mentioned on the PET, also on the Commodore 128. There's a sys command, which calls a machine language subroutine. And if you do sys 32800, 123, 45, 6, it will display the Commodore 128 development team. And also it has a peace message on there as well. And those are the ones that I know about for Commodore. There might be something on the Amiga too, but I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah, the ones that when we were thinking about this topic, the first thing that came to mind for me is the Karateka Apple II game. If you play this, so this is a Broderbund title, Jordan Mechner thing, and if you put the disc in upside down, then the game plays upside down, like the video is rendered upside down, because it's actually just it's a very simple change, and presumably in the game code there was a lookup table that said, if I want to draw on line 5, this is the address you put it in, and all you have to do is reverse the lookup table, and the whole thing's upside down. So that was a pretty cute thing, and you would
that
only notice it if
stinking
you
think and hilarious.
Mm. Yeah.
And of course it only works if you have a proper copy of the disc for both sides. So I'm assuming that there is a disc image out there for the back of the disc these days. So I haven't seen that in years, but
Well, I definitely went like I specifically tried to get an original Karateka disc specifically so I could try this, you know, like a, it's a well-distributed game, but...
It's even well-distributed in the original disc.
yeah. The game sold very well, yes. At least early Macs had a bunch of these kinds of things where, you know, there are things you can enter in the interrupt, what do you call it? I don't know what you call it, but if you interrupt it with the developer switch, you get a little prompt that gives you limited access to the machine, and you can jump to a particular address and see, the Mac SE, if you type G41D89A, which I think is... go to, you know, like jump to that particular address, it'll show you a little slideshow of the development team. And the stolen from Apple Computer, you can type G4188A4 and it'll put stolen from Apple Computer in the upper left, so that if you, you know, if you're working on a clone and you jump to that address, you can see evidence that this ROM is just copied.
Yeah, not quite as clean as they made out to be.
Yeah. But so yeah, I'll put a link in the show notes for, you know, so you can see these if you don't happen to have a Mac SE with an interrupt switch on hand.
Actually, speaking of interrupt switches, I need to find where mine is, because I was wanting to play with my 512K, but I noticed that the developer switch isn't there. I vaguely remember that I took it out to pack it up in the move, but I don't remember where I put it.
Yeah, I think I have at least a couple of these that got shattered in shipping. It's very annoying because, you know, like people don't know
that
what they are.
Yeah, and that it's not a permanent part of the, yeah. At least I was able to rescue mine from the computer when I picked it up, when I first got it. But we digress.
Yeah.
I think probably the most impressive Easter egg that I ever saw was in Microsoft Excel 97. And if you... typed the right things in the right cell, and then I think clicked on the little chart icon or something, you would go into a flight simulator, a 3D flight simulator thing that, and if you flew over the right spot, you would actually see this little, I don't know what you'd call it, little stone or something like that, that had rolling credits for the Excel developers.
Cool.
Yeah. Oh. I'll have to track that one down. I actually have Excel 97 on one of my emulators here. So
I wonder how many billable hours went into that.
Yeah, really.
Mm.
And if you don't want to actually track it down on the real thing at the moment, there is a YouTube video of it as well.
Oh, there's always a YouTube video.
One thing that I thought might count, I'm not sure if it does, but the 65816 had, you know, like a couple of unused opcodes, and one of them was actually given a code, you know, like a mnemonic WDM, which is Bill Mensch's initials. So I thought that was kind of cool. That's all. Not exactly an Easter egg, but if you're looking at the list of opcodes, there is a WDM, which is it's like a double length no op. So, you know, perhaps he was calling himself lazy. I'm not sure, but
at any rate, of course not. Well, while we're on not quite Easter eggs, another fun thing I like is micrographs. So little things extra etched into the silicon. So over at the Silicon Zoo, there is a great set of links and images for all different things etched into the silicon. So if you...
Oh, that's cool.
So I highly recommend this one for our listeners to pop over. Links provided and whole series of links of things that are in there. So even for us Dilbert fans, there's even some Dilbert etched in silicon.
Yeah, of course, that's the one I clicked directly on and caused me to exclaim that it was cool.
But there's flags, there's maps, there's even a Godzilla. Plenty of fun stuff. So I suppose give a techie half a chance and they'll do something interesting.
Always.
Let's move along. So we've got a little bit of listener feedback. So we have from Tony a Wired article on Margaret Hamilton and the AGC code. So have either of you guys had a chance to look at that article and how she got us to the moon?
I haven't. So that's the Apollo guidance computer we're talking about?
Yep.
Neat.
Yeah, and so the Wired article is not super new. It's from October, so it's not super old either. But it kind of goes through. It talks a little bit about Margaret Hamilton and you know, she I guess had worked on what you would essentially call the code for the Apollo guidance computer, and talks a little bit about the story of setting it up and how. It seems like there was a team of people. So by mid-1968, more than 400 people were working on this, but her name seems to also get associated with this quite prominently. So I think she was leading the team. They talk a little bit about how she had pointed out in a simulator. I forget if it was in this article, but, you know, that sort of, if you follow links and look into what she's done, there was a simulator that she noticed that it would start throwing errors if you started gathering navigational data while it was trying to land, and she was she wanted to add code that would keep you from doing that, but was told no one would ever do that. And of course, someone did that, and they had to kind of reconstruct the code in order to get home. I think it was on might have been Apollo 8, I think. Although there was something on 8. I couldn't quite tell if the issue was on Apollo 8 or Apollo 11 or both. But at any rate, there were a couple of things that needed some kind of like immediate on the ground reconstruction of code in order because someone did in fact start, you know, getting the navigational data at the same time as this computer was busy trying to land the thing. So, but it's interesting stuff.
Yeah. I suppose that they just wanted to document it and thus make it a feature and not a bug.
But it's interesting to read about, and I know, I'm sure we've talked about the Apollo guidance computer before, and I'm not sure exactly where. I think there are some pieces of this at InfoAge.
Yeah, I believe there is. And I like playing with the simulator, and I keep thinking about, my God, that is the hardest way that I know to actually drive a vehicle.
Right.
I'm sure it beat the pants off doing it all manually, but user interface 0 out of 10.
Right, but one of the things that this article is sort of, you know, pointing out is just the contributions that Margaret Hamilton herself made to the coding, and I think particularly the sort of fault tolerance, or, you know, zero fault tolerance for systems like this. So.
Yes, it's a whole new meaning to mission critical.
Right. Or perhaps an original meaning.
quite possibly. Yeah. Okay. Now, the link that I liked the most that had been sent to us was from Mike on a Canadianized ZX Spectrum. I suppose in so much as that the power supply was fiddled, and he also made a minor change to video, so he didn't have to use the RF out. But that was quite an entertaining video on a belated first look at a Spectrum. So it's got some great shots of the machine, of it being used, and. Yeah, you know, in there he says that the video is a little bit basic, but I actually found the video quite enjoyable, and it gave a great size perspective of the Spectrum itself. As he says, you don't realize how small it is until you pick it up, and, you know, really all it is pretty much some black plastic and a keyboard to look at it. You know, you sort of think, oh, where's the computer? I've got the keyboard. But, it's quite an entertaining little video of one person's fun with playing with a ZX Spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, I guess it was put together originally for Retro Battle Stations, Reddit.
For Sinclair Month.
Right. And so, basic or not, there are some really very impressive kind of like 3D rendered chip graphic things in there. I'm not sure if those were borrowed or if those were created for this, but if they were created for this, that was not basic at all. That was quite impressive.
No, I think he was referring to his cameo role, introducing the computer.
Yeah, he said something in there about how he was going to originally make this into some kind of like thing with a plot, you know, like a movie of some sort. And so there's a little bit of footage in there of that. And he also shows relatively clearly like the modifications he made to make it work, you know, like in an NTSC, you know, North American world.
Mm. And the Ferranti chip, basically setting it up for the I believe it was the ULA. But then he also shows some pictures of a Ferranti computer over at the museum in London. So some very nice big iron there. But I like a video that has a little bit of running off at the tangent. And I think he managed to do quite a creative video. It captivated me from start to end, and I've added him to my subscription list.
Yep. So. Yep. And the I like the YouTube ID as well. It's OBSO1337, which you can work out for yourself. But.
Huh. Well, I can't wait to see this. I guess I have something to do right after the podcast is done.
In between Easter eggs.
Yeah.
Okay, so in the wonderful world of interest and news, Earl, you have a hiatus to report that is over.
I do, and thank goodness, because this website is really useful. It is the Web 8201 website, and it caters to enthusiasts for the NEC PC8201 and PC8300 laptops. And these were the ones that are the NEC cousins to like the Tandy Model 100, Tandy Model 102, and that very similar firmware, and really neat little laptops with a very crisp LCD displays. I was always impressed with the displays on these guys, and I actually have one. I need to get the battery pack refixed up so that I can use it. So with this website on the air, maybe it's time for me to get off my bottom and do that. So you'll find all kinds of reference information over here, information on programming, service manuals, user manuals, and just a bunch of enthusiasm for these little guys. I think you've got one too, don't you, Paul?
Yes. The answer is yes, I have one. One of the 8201As, and I also have a couple of hundreds and at least one 102, maybe two 102s. I just got a 200, just quite, you know, like, I think since the last recording. So
I read that. Those are an interesting beast.
Yeah, I'm fairly keen to get working on that. But one of the things that is actually sort of right here at the top of the Web 8201 is the there's a note about buying the Rex, which is something that it allows you to have. I guess it allows you to either... I'm not sure actually what it is. It lets you download new ROMs, custom ROMs to it.
Well, the Rex is a couple of different things mixed into one. One is that, yes, it has flash memory and can let you switch between various option ROMs for the machine. The second is it'll let you take your entire current existence on the machine and back it up to one of several backup slots. So... as you know, and enthusiasts of these machines will know, that it's interesting that your programming RAM and your data RAM and all that is all kind of the same thing, and it's all non-volatile and sits in the machine, but there can be circumstances like a full reset in which you lose all your stuff. So one of the things you can do with the Rex is say, make me a backup and put it in this slot, and then later on, you can come back and say restore from that backup, and boom, your machine is right back where you left it.
Cool.
So it's actually a neat little chip. I really like it. I have it in one of my Model 100s.
Yeah, I was thinking that if I ever wanted to, you know, really get serious about using these, and I do want to get serious, but at the point that I want to get serious about it, I think I might want to get one of these. And also, the other thing that seems to be A very useful thing is this NADS box. What I'm not sure about, so when I've looked around at the various Model 100 and sites related to that, like Club 100 and so forth, it's not super clear to me if they're still available. So it looks like the Rex is, because this the posting about the Rex is just you know, a couple weeks ago. But do you know if the NADS box, the CF SD card storage, is that still viable?
Those are getting to be unobtainium at this point. Mm-hmm. Apparently, at least at the moment, there's not going to be another run of those. It was determined to be uneconomical to make another run. So there were a couple of people recently on the Model 100 email list that were looking for one. There are some other options, though. I believe you can do something similar with a Raspberry Pi. And there's a piece of software called Ladi Alpha that functions like the Tandy portable disk drive, giving you essentially a lot of the same functionality that you would get out of the NADS box. The NADS box is nice as in that it's just so portable. You can take it with you wherever you go without a bunch of plugins. It just connects up to the top of the Model 100. But yeah, I don't know if those are going to be available anymore brand new. It might be something that you have to scavenge for a while.
But on the other hand, if you can do something with a Raspberry Pi, you know, just for the cost of the $5 zero and a connector, that I can see why it could be uneconomical to make a full dedicated box.
Right. They weren't cheap, actually. They I don't remember exactly what they did cost, but they were not inexpensive. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know. I know that they were expensive enough that I didn't buy them back when I saw that they were, you know, like back when I first heard about them years ago. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, which comes back to the old saw, sort of, if you see something interesting, buy it. But, they're always constrained by budget. So, yeah, be interesting to see if the schematics for that built and all the build documents could possibly be made available. Things like that definitely have more of an appeal to me as a turnkey device rather than say something through a Raspberry Pi. If you can use the Raspberry Pi, so that's basically turn it on and use it rather than getting in to a terminal, that'd be better. But I always like to just be able to pick up a box and connect it in and put the SD card in and go for it. But yeah, things move on,
But hooray, the website's back on the air, so welcome back to the internet, web8201.net.
Yes, I'm quite excited to kind of browse around it now, because I think the site was gone when I first started getting into the stuff, so very nice.
Well, it definitely looks very interesting. Well, another interesting thing that came past my desktop, it's kind of on the cusp of not retro enough for me, but I'm going to cover it anyway, because what this is it's a package of scripts that you can use on any Macintosh from System 7.1 through to OS, the current OS 10, 10.11. So 7.1, that's your Mac 2, I think, I always think that to me the cutoff for a retro Mac is System 6. But what this one does show is that by the use of scripts on these machines, so you need Apple Script to be running on the 7.1, how to integrate your retro machine into a modern network environment, so file sharing, print sharing. So it looks like a great little system for a person who is a little bit network protocol shy, a little bit cabling shy. Here is a way of just getting your older machine into your network so that you can do some file and print sharing. Fairly basic. I believe it's a 30 euro buy now for the package of scripts, but it looks like quite a well done little system.
Cool. Yeah, I actually just was doing something a little bit like this. I'm trying to remember what I was trying to do. I think I was trying to image a floppy that I got. And so I was trying to connect. I have a Duo 2300C. Actually, one that I am the original owner of. I bought it back when it was new, and I like it a lot. But so I was just, you know, trying to figure out, you know, I connected the drive and imaged the disk and so forth. But then, of course, it was the disk image was now trapped on my 2300C. So there's a thing that I discovered. I think I had discovered it before, but called Mac IPGW, which you can find out about at macip.net. And it's a virtual machine for VirtualBox. And so with the help of that, I was able to put a Mac IP server on the local network that I could then talk to from the 2300C using a little, what is that called? It's a Farallon device that will connect, will sort of translate from AppleTalk.
AppleTalk connector to Ethernet. Yeah.
Right.
And I've got one of those and a couple of other brands as well. Very handy to keep them around.
Mm-hmm. Those are very helpful. I've got an Asante that does the same thing.
Yeah, it was super cool. You know, I didn't entirely, it didn't fully 100% work, but I was able to get at least at a shared volume over AppleTalk or AppleShare and, you know, just copy the image over that way. But it was an interesting adventure, and it's really pretty cool to be able to just, like, you know, connect directly to the drive image on my you know, like modern Mac. So,
you know, I feel like, didn't System 7 come out in the early 90s?
Yeah, 91. So that's why I say it's right on the cusp. You know, it's a little bit too new for me at times.
Wow, but that's 25 years ago.
I know, but it's that feel of where the system software was basically changing, and it's starting to lose its retroness. It's very hard to describe, and different people have different takes on what's retro, because I'm sure there are kids out there that think retro was 5 years ago, but
right,
or the world before the iPhone.
But there are still, you know, sort of interesting things even when we're talking about, like, you know, macOS 10.0, you know. But yeah, I do have this feeling, like, you know, once it hits system 9, it might be, you know, like, I think I would no longer really consider it retro, but I don't know.
It's just old. Okay. So, well, you've got the microphone there, Paul. We got some SIDCHIP information.
Yeah, so I just saw a posting fairly recently for a kind of a bizarre device. So what this is, it's the SIDFX. And so what it is a little device that you can use you plug it into a Commodore 64 or friend, you know, like 64, 128, SX64. And it will allow you to use one or two SID chips. So I guess if you can take out the SID chip and put this device in its place, and then find some other SID chip and put it in. And apparently there are, so I'm not super SID savvy, so perhaps Earl can help me out on this. But I gather that there were a couple of different versions of the SID chip, and one of the things that this device allows you to do is mismatch them or use different, you know, use both kinds. And when they're both in there, you can have twice as many voices. So a hard to find part already, but if you happen to have two of them, then you can use them both.
And the only thing that I guess gives me a little pause on something like this looks really cool, is just hoping that people won't trash out a Commodore 64 just to harvest the SID chip, because I have heard of that happening. The SID is tough to come by, and you're right that SID enthusiasts will be able to tell you the difference between the different SID models. So there could be purists that want to have one version of the SID for one thing and another version of the SID for another thing based on, I don't know, when the demo came out or when their game came out or whatever. So that makes sense to me. But oh boy, I hope we don't go on a SID rating party, because Commodore 64s themselves, while they used to be practically free, they're still fairly easily obtained, but the SID chip itself, they're in quite the demand.
Yeah, it does seem like it's a, that's the thing that I find strangest about this, is that, you know, like, I know that there's a demand for SID chips, and that here's a thing that is going to require you to find one. And they pretty much only exist as harvested, right? I mean, like, you can't find them any other place.
That's, yes, as far as I know, that's true.
Yeah, there's projects fly by every now and again for creating a SID chip emulator or a simulator, so FPGA projects, but always seems to fall down on timing issues and not being quite the same. And of course, it's probably not going to be plug compatible, but as you said, it's an interesting project. I can understand why it's there and what it could be used for, but yeah, I suppose it's a bit like the old someone wakes up and finds stitches in the side and they've become an unintentional kidney donor. But
right, the status of the project is right now in a pre-order stage, so it's not actually available, but because I think they're expensive enough to make, you need to commit to your 80 euro purchase, and then apparently it will be produced for you.
And if you wanted to use the multiple voices, your software would have to know how to take advantage of that. Like most things that you connect up to a 6502, this is probably just taking that second SID chip when you're using them together and putting it at a different spot in the memory map. And that way the SID registers would be available, like you kind of would be mirrored. You'd have two different locations where you'd have sets of SID registers that you could poke with.
Mm-hmm. There's a demo video on the site that shows like you playing some sort of a music playing program, and he's got little switches that he can turn on and off each SID chip, so you can see that there's actually, you know, whatever it is, six voices or something coming out. But yeah, it does seem like you'd have to either write your own software or use that music player.
Well, I think it's time for a little bit of a fun break, though possibly this link might be more of a frustration break. So,
but when you're done flying the Apollo module.
Our ever clever friends over at MassWorks have a little game treat for us called Fleet Action, based on Space War. Now, I've been trying to play this game ever since I became aware of it, so for the last couple of days, and I will put air quotes around trying to play this game. I'm finding it very difficult. All I can say is gravity sucks. But it is a great little simulation, so a little bit of HTML5 programming at its best, I suspect. But pop over to MassWork with links supplied. It's a two-player game, so you've got to share the keyboard. So this might not be a good game for a small, cramped keyboard. But you get to move your initial fleet of four ships around. Very difficult to do. I suppose I'm slightly more uncoordinated than your typical gamer, but I keep trying. It is great. It is very, very exceedingly retro, and I thoroughly recommend it. Though you may also want to pop over and try their Eliza with Voice Simulator on the way out if you need a little bit of counseling from trying to play this game. But it's based on the original Space War. Has the round CRT display. It is wonderful. It's a wonderful piece of programming. It is a wonderful rendition of a new game based on some old retro classic. But boy, am I lousy at it.
It was pretty tough. I took it for a test flight myself and found it kind of difficult, like you, Michael. I will say that the simulation of the CRT vector graphics is really neat.
Yeah, it's one of the better vector graphic simulations I've seen.
Yeah, these folks over at MassWork, they have such a sense of style. If you look at their Card Punch Google search and the what was the other one that they did? Google from the 80s, and they made it like a dial-up BBS, and some of the other things that they've done, their artwork combined with their retro sensibilities, I don't know. I continue to be very impressed by them, and this Space War was no exception.
Mm. Yeah, I'm not even convinced it's really possible, this game. But as you've been talking about it, I've been attempting not to. I can manage to like keep one ship alive.
Oh, that's better than me. The best I can do is to... And that's only in single-player mode. I'd hate the thought of trying it in two-player mode, is destroying the opposition before my last ship crashes into the black hole, the sun, or whatever, at the center. But I just can't seem to coordinate movement and shooting all at the same time. But maybe that's why I was never any good at Doom.
But it is beautiful. Yeah, this everything we've linked to this site several times in the past, and
they just keep giving us cause to keep linking.
Yeah, so it's wonderful. If you're listening,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, gold medal, you win. Okay, so Earl, you've got the next one for us. A little bit of something for the BBC Micro.
As if the keyboard of the BBC Micro or the BASIC weren't impressive enough, I had no clue that with a BBC Micro that you could make an external coprocessor module and plug it in, and then the CPU that's in the BBC says, oh, okay, I'll go into coprocessor mode or whatever, and then it lets you have a more powerful processor for the machine. Did you guys know it could do that?
No.
Nope, I had no idea.
And paint me impressed.
That is so neat. So one of the coprocessors was a 32016 processor, and I don't even really know that much about it, except apparently it was pretty powerful, pretty fast, and they actually made one of these coprocessor boxes that you could plug into the BBC, and this was way back in the day. Well, I imagine those boxes are a pretty penny if you could even come across one, so some folks have managed to recreate this functionality with an FPGA board. Specifically, I think in this case they used the TerraSic DE0 FPGA board, which actually has a pretty beefy FPGA on it in terms of the number of gates and the capabilities. So I took a look at this and I thought, wow, this is just so neat, so impressive. They have effectively, on the FPGA, recreated this CPU. And they, if I remember reading it right, they might have used an FPGA core that was already out there for that CPU. But then you have to make the glue logic and the electrical connection to hook it up to the BBC. And a couple of folks were collaborating on this, and they were several hundred miles apart. So one would do one thing, the other would test it, and they'd go back and forth, and finally they got the thing working just like the original coprocessor box. So there were, I guess, languages for this, like C and Pascal and Fortran, and man, I would just love to try some of this. It sounded exciting, but I wanted to give them a tip of the hat and link to the project, and I've been on a little FPGA kick of my own trying to learn about them, so I thought this was good. And also, we don't give the BBC enough love. I don't have any hands-on with it, of course, being over here on the wrong side of the pond, but there you have it, and we'll have a link for that up in the show notes.
Now, looking at the performance section of the website that we've got the link for, and yeah, it's... quite impressive.
Yeah, pretty neat stuff, huh?
Mm.
That is pretty wild. So do you mean that the actual BBC Micro itself was already aware that this could be plugged in and would sense it? Like it was designed from the beginning to be able to do this?
Yeah, that's what they were saying, that it was designed from the beginning to be extensible with a coprocessor.
Mm.
Very cool. Yeah, it would be a lot of fun to try this out. The BBC Micro is one that I continue to want to get hold of at some point. One of these, probably like, I think they're Model B or whatever is the one that, the canonical one.
But, what they say here at the top of the page is, what made the BBC Micro Model B very interesting was its expansion concept. One could add another processor to the system and the original one became an I.O. controller. The other processors were called second processor. They were placed in a separate box, contained their own power supply, and were connected via a 40-pin ribbon cable to the BBC Micro. So there you go. That's a straight-up quote from this website.
Cool. So it almost sounds like it is like a terminal mode. But
Yeah. It does, doesn't it?
That sort of makes you wonder, like, how far could you actually push that second processor concept? Sort of where could you go using that with today's bits and pieces?
Your Core
i7. Connect an A9. Would be somewhat hilarious.
No, that is something I was not aware of for the BBC. And, guys, you got some great links this show. I have lots of follow-up and homework to do for myself.
Yeah, I know, me too.
Yeah. Well, Paul, you have some information about an interview from 1994?
Yeah, so this, speaking of things that are, you know, possibly too late to be retro, but just recently there was a YouTube link posted that was, it basically contains an interview with Ken and Roberta Williams from, I think it was a CD-ROM that was released in 1994. So the interview was there, and it was super low resolution. It had been on the internet before. You know, you could find it elsewhere on YouTube, but this was a particularly well cleaned up one, and I hadn't watched it before. It was pretty interesting. But so, in case the names already weren't familiar, Ken and Roberta Williams they founded online software initially, which became Sierra Online, which became Sierra, and, you know, a monster of the gaming world. So it was really pretty interesting hearing them talk about, you know, getting an Apple II in 1979 and, you know, getting together, writing Mystery House, which was the first online thing. And, you know, just sort of talking about there's a bit of probably the first half of the video is kind of about the philosophy of gaming and what they're, you know, like, I don't know, there's a little bit of just history and talking about how it all came to be. And then it winds up, you know, getting into the more 1990s stuff that is sort of self-promotional, I think it's a neat video. And it sort of feels like these are stories that I hadn't heard before. And so I kind of just followed, you know, the path on this a little bit. And I had thought that online, you know, they started out as online, and they made a couple of different things, like an assembler and some games and things like this. And then later they became known as Sierra Online. And I thought, okay, well, this is straightforwardly a merger of some company called Sierra and online. There was, in fact, in the early 80s, a company called Sierra Software that I had assumed had merged with online to create Sierra Online. But I later discovered that, in fact, actually, Sierra Software is just somebody else entirely. This is Sierra Software was, what's his name? Alec Jebchenko, who wrote a few games, actually, for the Apple II. And another link that I have here is an interview in Softline 1982 magazine with Alec Jebchenko. It's actually phonetically reproduced there in the article, talking about his games. And that's actually, his stuff is kind of interesting. So I kind of wanted to detour into that a little bit, because he did... there were a couple of games that were sort of like physics-based. One of them was like a lunar lander thing. And there was another one called Retro Ball, which had a kind of interesting hack that you could do to the Apple II, which was the Apple II had no vertical blank information, so you couldn't really tell when the screen was being redrawn. And he had worked out a way that you could actually... I forget how he did this, but it was basically a way to listen. He sent the video signal out into the cassette in, and he would listen to the video signal to see when the vertical blank was. it was a very cool thing. But so this game came with a little like hardware adapter that would allow you to do this, and it's discussed a little bit in this Softline interview. But so I learned that first of all, there's interesting stuff from Ken and Roberta Williams on the founding and sort of like the first whatever it is 14 years of Sierra, And also that online, that Sierra Software is somebody else from different from online. But anyway, I have other links too, but maybe I'll stop talking just to let you react a bit.
Well, yes, I was aware of Canon Roberta and online, but no, I was the same as you. I thought that Sierra Software must have been something that they merged with, and now I've been educated, and they are not. But boy, that is a novel way of finding your vertical interrupt. I must admit, I would never have thought of that. Literally listening for it.
It's a very cool idea. I don't know how well it worked, but it is a neat thing that I kind of want to try now, because it seems like you could hook it up pretty easily.
And you'd think if it was successful that other companies would have wanted to do that too, so that you'd just wind up with a standalone product. But I guess that's not what happened. But I didn't know, actually, that the Apple II didn't have that vertical blank signal that you could tune into. So it's fascinating.
Oh, there's lots of little things that people wish the Apple II had.
Yeah. Yeah, I think later, it might have been later 2Es and the 2C did have a vertical blank sensing, but the 2 Plus and earlier didn't. Anyway, I thought it was interesting that in that issue of Softline, also, you know, earlier in the issue, Ken Williams himself has a column where he's talking about the Apple II high-res graphics. So, you know, these people both appeared in the same issue, but different. At that point, it was Online and Sierra, and then Online became Sierra Online, and Sierra, I think, just disappeared. So. I'll put it, without talking about them much here, I'll put a couple of other links. So there's a Jimmy Maher from a while back had a nice sort of overview on the founding, the kind of like imploding and then reinvigorating of Sierra Software, of Sierra Online, which became Sierra. And also there was, we may have mentioned her before, but Lane Nooney has I think relatively recently written a dissertation, or maybe it's still in the finishing stages, which was sort of covering the history of Sierra Online. And I think she's also turned her attention somewhat to Brodermund as well. So there's a link to her site where she's got some of her research documented. It's pretty interesting though. She's going through old documents and memos and things and visiting original sites.
Very interesting. Okay, and here's a word from our sponsor.
Gloria Daphne longs to be alone with her very own BBC Micro. Alas for Daphne, Acorn have also made it rather attractive to small businessmen.
Hello, Dad.
Tragically, they've even made it irresistible to accountants.
Hello, Uncle Cyril.
And sad to say, it's become vital for everyone who needs up-to-the-minute information. Thanks to its Presto and Teletext adapters. Worst of all, it's absolutely bung-ho for busy administrators. And then there are those visitors who want to use its unearthly scientific potential. Poor Daphne. The BBC microcomputer system is a world leader, and it's still growing.
Okay, and welcome back, everybody. Well, it's the host retro computing gift idea, and I was having a bit of trouble trying to link computers and Easter, and I was sort of hoping that there might have been something like a Fabergé egg based on a computer or something like that, but no, there's not. So the other Easter fallback is chocolate, and on that I was successful. So here is a link, and in it you will find 3.5-inch and 5.25-inch chocolate floppy disks. Now, I suppose they're not too floppy, but I haven't tried these. I cannot vouch for the quality of the chocolate that is contained within these disks, but boy, it looks good.
Well, they might be floppy if they got too warm, but you probably don't want that. So, yum.
Yeah, it's a confectionery company, and we'll provide a link to take you straight into their molded chocolate computer novelties section. And down the bottom of the scroll right down, and there is the extra large floppy disk. A 5 1/4 inch one. 5.5 ounces of chocolate. $12.50.
Oh, it's actually to scale.
Yeah, isn't that cool? You get one of these and wait for it. Have a few bites.
I'll be nibbling on this one.
That's pretty cool. So, yeah, you could actually like so put this in a real floppy sleeve and then and mail it off to somebody.
Yeah. As long as they don't put it in their floppy drive.
Yeah. So yeah, they got a chocolate circuit board, 3.5 inch disc. There's a chocolate CD. So lots of fun things. So if you're after a little bit of chocolate in the computer form, pop over, have a look.
Oh, they have them in little lollipop forms too. Not the discs, I guess, but very cool.
Yeah, chocolate at or a dot com. Now, when I came across that, I thought, oh, that is so interesting, and I certainly hope it tastes good. Well, enough about chocolate. Let's get back to some real computers. So, in our eBay auction selection, Earl, compact flash hard drive?
Yeah, I want one of these. Want.
It's starting to sound like the Penguin from Batman.
Do you want one of these?
I really do want one. It's called the XT CF Lite. It's an 8-bit IDE compact flash hard drive. Goes in an ISA slot, unlike your PC, PCXT, PC-compatible machines. And you use a compact flash card for your hard drive instead of one of the old and, unfortunately, rapidly deteriorating series of hard drives that you'd normally find in a PC like a Seagate ST225 or an ST251, which would be fun to have, but not quite as convenient, a little noisy. This thing's quiet, and when you want to put software on it, you just pop out the compact flash, put it in your PC, and copy some things over, and boom, there you go. So they're really neat devices. People sing their praises, and you know, you guys have talked a lot about the CFFA 3000, which does have slightly more functionality than something like this, but this is kind of the equivalent in the PC compatible realm. And so this one here isn't a kit, it's all constructed. You can have it for $100 with about $7 shipping. So that's my pick.
Add to watch list. Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's I have a version 2. Just bare PCB that I have yet to build. Like, you know, it's taken me so long to get to it that they've bumped up 2 version numbers now.
Oh, you're going to have to go source your parts too, or do you already have the parts?
No, I decided I was just going to get the boards and I'd be able to find the parts. And so that was the last I heard of it for probably a couple years now.
Gotcha.
So I would very much like to put one together because I have machines that could use them, but, I very much like the already built aspect of this one.
Mm. So just reading the description here, it looks like it's a little bit more flexible than some of the CF to IDE adapters that are available. So it's probably more that it's got the BIOS on the card rather than also relying on the compatibility of the CF card into the IDE adapter. So no, this is
yes.
Quite a good little device. And looking at the form factor of the card there, they've got, it looks like to me that you can access the actual CF card without reopening up the PC. So that's a good design.
Yeah, I think that's quite cool. It looks like it sticks out the back.
Which is one of the problems of the CF to IDE adapters is that it basically ends up being inside the machine unless you sling the ribbon cable out. But
one other thing, if you're handy with the soldering iron, don't mind building your own. The same seller has these in kit form for $70 plus the $7 shipping. So depends on whether you want to build it yourself or if you want one that's already put together.
But this one, but the kit does come with all the pieces, including the BIOS, I think. So.
Yep.
So you don't actually have to source anything. You just need to actually assemble it.
Mm. Yeah, well, if you're good with a soldering iron, then save yourself $30. Or just decide that $30, have it made and tested and ready to go. No, very, very nice find there, Earl. And as Paul said, I've added that one to my watch list. I'm going to go and check out the kit one. Okay, well, I might just put my find in here. I was looking at getting a new set of headphones just for general use. And then I got to thinking, well, I have these retro computers, and sometimes I want to listen to them, or at least allow other people not to listen to them. And I got thinking, well, I should actually have some more period-appropriate headphones. So I thought I would go looking on eBay, so any excuse to go for a bit of a drive, and I have found a over-the-ears headphone for the 1960s, the 1970s, and the 1980s. Just an example of what you can find out there. Now, I found a few other older models that didn't have the quarter-inch jack on them, but I wasn't quite sure of how they would go with just sort of coming up with some kind of little adapter, the impedance and whatnot for those. So I thought I'd stick with some more modern and definitely in the retro realm. So I have a from the 60s, a Pioneer SE2P, which it definitely cries out 1960s to me when I saw it. I didn't need to actually confirm the era, but it's a nice over-the-ears headphone. Of course, you know, any foam or plastic is going to be a bit of a chance as to how good it's going to feel over your ears when if you buy something like this to try out. Now, for the 1970s, I have, I'm going to mangle this, Hosden DH150ZS, and it's a very retro style headset. I'm sure it's not quite as cream when it first came out, but if you want to retro bright that to bring it up, but this one has the on headset controls for volume and tone. So if you want to play with that there, so that in itself to me was very retro in the style for your listening pleasure. And if you want something to go with your 1980s computers, there's a Realistic Nova 14, which I've linked to. And this one, also in this auction here, actually comes with the original box and packaging, and you've got your left and right volume actually there on the headset. So if you're going to be listening, you might as well be listening in period.
This is really cool. I think my favorite of the three are the 70s headset with that
yes.
cream color.
Mm.
Man, that just cries out for some disco music.
Yeah, I think those would be my choice as well. And I don't know that I've ever seen headphones that have these controls on them, but the ones with the 70s one, they have tone and volume for each ear.
Mm. So you can get your own personal balance. But I remember back at university and before university using headphones and seeing headphones that looked like this. Obviously these were sort of being used by people for their audio setups, not for computer setups back then, but you can easily get a quarter inch to 3.5 mil jack adapters and use these on your retro machines. There'll be varying levels of success. One of the problems of buying old headsets like this is the quality over time and the connections. So now there may be a little bit of a crackle as you move, but I've had modern day headsets that only after a couple of years start to have problems. This is where
yes.
your wireless technologies really come into the fore. But if you want to curly cable connector back to your classic computer, one of these is probably going to be the ticket for you.
Neato. Or should I say groovy?
Groovy, man, groovy. So, Paul, I'm sure you're going to be good to form and you're going to show me and our listeners some interesting computers that we could possibly plug our newly acquired headphones into.
Quite possibly, yes. Well, okay, so again, I have a relatively long list here, but I'll
a plethora.
I'll edit as we go, perhaps. But the first one that I saw, I have never seen this before. So the first auction I'm linking to is two new old stock Radio Shack TRS-80 Color Computer 2 kits, unbuilt.
Wow.
I had no idea that you could buy these.
Yeah.
Well, I was aware, but I've only read about it. I've never actually seen it.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's, there are two of them. They come in the original box, and the box has a label on the side that says, 64K extended kit. And so there's, it's a kit. It's a board. It's a bunch of chips and components that you soldered together yourself. One of the kits is completely unopened. The other kit is, the box has been opened, but the plastic wrap is still unopened. And then the other kit is, I think, missing a chip or two or something. But they're being sold together. And as I said, I know Radio Shack was the place you bought a little electronics and things, but I really did not know that the Color Computer 2 was ever available as a kit. So right now these two are at a bid of $255, so apparently it surprised a lot of people.
These are going to go for $1 million.
Yeah, I think they are.
They're going to go for a lot of money.
Yeah, for an auction that started at a starting price of 99 cents, it's really been moving along.
And it's got 6 days left to go.
Yeah, 6 days to go. There's five bidders in there already. And I must admit, it is so much just to... I'm going to put it on my watch list, but boy, it's going to take a lot of self-control not to dive into this one. Oh.
Well, and on the other hand, if you dive in right now, you will be outbid.
Oh, yeah.
So the risk is low.
Yeah. I can say that in 6 days and 5 hours' time or so, it's going to be very difficult in not to start trying for a final bid. So, yeah, this is beautiful. I love kits. I love retro computers, and this is all of it coming together in a perfect storm.
So you'd buy it and then just assemble it, right?
Oh yeah,
of course.
Of course. Hey, I'm one of those guys that, new, mint, software, in shrink wrap. Well, that's just one clear piece of plastic between me and opening up the box. No, I would have absolutely no hesitation at all in getting the soldering iron out and going for both of these.
Yeah, likewise.
Mm. I'm sure there's going to be people who will be send hate mail to my...
No, well, I do hope if this winds up... I hope that the person who gets it, if they do wind up building it, and I think that probably is unlikely, but if they do, I hope it's captured on video.
Oh, yes. That's definitely a great little... Well, actually, it'd be a wonderful project for the forthcoming Summer Computer Challenge, mm-hmm. Retro Computer Challenge, document doing that. Oh. No. Oh, that is gold, Paul. That is one of the best ones that you have come up with. Your Google foo is amazing.
Well, so I guess the remaining things will be less exciting, perhaps. But
Are you building up to a crescendo, perhaps?
If I thought about it, but anyway. So let's see. The next thing that was another thing that I hadn't heard of is a IBM game that they marketed called 101 Monochrome Mazes. And so this is, it's a little gray IBM folder of the sort that they sold their games in. And it has a nice colorful manual. And it's not completely clear to me whether the discs, I think the discs are just copies, because I assume they would have had real labels originally. Although looking into this, it was not copy protected, so That's not surprising. This seems to have been a dealer demo, so these may well have been the discs that came with it originally. But what's kind of interesting about this is that it is specifically for monochrome, like the monochrome display adapter. It doesn't work on anything else. So first of all, I had not heard of it before. I certainly had not seen it before. And when I researched it a little bit, apparently it's basically like an ASCII, or, well, you know, the graphical text character game. But it works only on the monochrome. And part of the reason for that is that if you try to use it on a color display, then you can see where all the hidden things are in the maps just by the way it, due to the way it kind of represents things in memory. So there's a, I'll put a link in the show notes. I don't have it on hand right now, but a little dissection of this and kind of showing why this isn't monochrome only, why it was not allowed for the color things. But it's an interesting thing anyway. So have either of you played this or seen it?
I wasn't even aware of it, and I like that bit about the color reveals all.
Yeah. Anyway, so if you're interested in this, it's you know, they know it's rare, and they also don't know how to use a camera, or at least they don't know how to use the focus button. But so it's a $60 starting bid, and buy it now for $119. So. It ships internationally if you're interested.
Yes. I can confirm that it has international shipping.
Let's see, what else? I will mention this just because this is something that I wasn't aware of, but there is an auction for an ITT Extra XP vintage personal computer system with still shrink-wrapped manuals and SAM Noord 3, I guess, that comes with it. It's kind of a neat little box. It's I think it might be an XT compatible computer, and it looks really, it's in nice shape. It's very new. It doesn't have a keyboard, or I think that there probably was a matching monitor that went with it too. Although at least the monitor is probably replaceable. Actually, the keyboard too probably is. You could probably use a PC keyboard on it, but it's a nice sort of little compact PC clone in very new looking condition. And I think it looks kind of nice. The reviews at the time suggested that it was kind of unpleasantly boxy, but I mean, I think that the 5150 is equally unpleasantly boxy, I would say.
I kind of like the boxy nature of this. It almost reminds me of the expansion chassis for the 99.4. This is actually, I think, a neat looking computer in retrospect.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind displaying this.
Cosmetically in very good condition. Connectors on the back don't seem to be distressed. And normally you see a little bit of surface rust up around the blanking plates for the cards, and that all looks in beautiful condition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think this must have been just purchased and then put in a closet.
Mm.
You know, the keyboard lost and the monitor put somewhere else, and then everything else just untouched. But it's basically just going for whatever the market will give it. So it's right now.
And it even has the cardboard head protectors for the floppy drive.
Yeah, yep. Totally new.
Mm.
Apart from the missing keyboard. But so anyway, I thought that was interesting, and not a brand I'd ever heard of before. I mean, ITT I'd heard of, but not the Extra. So. Very nice. I will skip over, or I mean, I will mention, but skip over, there was a Bondi Blue iMac computer auction that I was going to talk about, and it was already sold. So it was listed at buy it now for $450, and I thought that might actually hold for a little while. But what I thought was sort of interesting about this one was that, so the Bondi Blue iMac is the very first model. Had a tray loading CD, and you know, it was underpowered relative to the later iMacs. But this one had the box, and I had never, you see the iMacs all over the place on eBay, even the Bondi Blue ones, but I had never seen one being sold with the box and all the stuff.
I picked up one with the all the manuals and all the extras that came with it, but not the box. And that makes a big difference. It's a very nice collection, that one. But as to underpowered, yes, it is. But it's a It's a nice machine. I use mine every now and again for reading some CDs from my camera.
Mm-hmm. And I kind of like the fact that it's a tray. So, because the ones that when you put the CD in to the whatever you call the ones that suck them in,
the slot loaders, yeah.
Yeah, I'm always just terrified that it's just going to get stuck. I'm never going to get out of it again.
Yeah, well, that's the reason I use it with my my Sony Mavica camera, because it records the photos on the little micro CDs.
Oh, right.
So yeah. The camera came with an adapter that you could click the micro CD in and use a full-size CD drive, or even if you were brave, foolhardy, your choice, put that into a slot loader. I never was brave nor foolhardy enough to try that. But yeah, that's one of the main reasons I keep it around and connected up on my network, is that if I need to get something off a CD, to start with, you need a computer that can take a CD.
Right.
Which is getting harder and harder to do. But no, that was a nice one there. Don't know if I would have paid $450 just to get the box, but it definitely looks in good condition. And
And I think the last one that I'll mention is this thing that I had not heard of before, and it seems pretty cool. It's called Freeze Frame, and it is it looks like it's a cartridge, basically, that you put in the Commodore 64 that will basically halt the machine and print the screen. So it's from Cardco Inc., which I think they make various Commodore peripherals. But this is still wrapped, still new, and looks like a pretty cool bit of technology. So Earl, is this a familiar thing to you?
Well, I was trying to think of where I'd heard of this before, and I realized I was just looking at the February 1986 Computes Gazette, because I've got a stack of Computes Gazette from 86 and 87 exactly 30 years ago, and so I've been going through them as if they were like a new magazine subscription, and there was an ad for this. So that's where I've heard of it. I've never used it, though, but I agree with you that it does seem like a pretty neat thing. It'd be nice to be able to push a button and get a print screen on a Commodore 64. And you're right, Cardco made some really nice stuff for the 64, especially with respect to printers.
Yeah, it seems to me like this is it's not something that you can do easily on the, well, I was going to say it's not something you can do easily on the Apple II, but yeah, it is. Never mind. but it does seem like it's, you know, a nicely engineered product, at least.
Yeah.
I would imagine it would actually be harder, in fact, with a Commodore, because you have to take into account where sprites and stuff are. On an Apple II, you just, like, grab the RAM, you know, the video RAM, and print it. Anyway, so if you want one, there's a still wrapped new old stock one, starting bid of $15. Lasts for 6 days, and Earl can tell me later if he wants me to cut this out of the show.
No, well, that's quite an interesting haul there, for Paul, and really, really love that color computer kits. I suppose I'd make the opened one and then sort of try to restrain myself on the unopened one. Don't know how successful I'd be. Probably not. Okay, so do we have any closing discussions? Anything that you just want to drop in on us? Earl, anything from you?
I guess the only thing I'd say is one of our listeners had been kind enough to send me an FPGA board and a book on Verilog, which is one of the languages with which you can program FPGAs. And I've been digging into that stuff like crazy and having a lot of fun. I'm not to the point of being able to do anything useful with it yet in terms of making a peripheral for our beloved old retro computers or anything like that.
Creating your own SID chip.
Yeah, exactly. But I did come up with an interesting project for my son and I. He's currently going through a computer science degree at Portland State University here in town. And I thought, hey, let's make our own computer. And when I say make our own computer, I mean actually design a CPU and implement it in hardware with one of these FPGAs, and then maybe make a language for it and an OS for it and just go crazy. And I think this would be not a multi-month, but maybe a multi-year project to understand how to put together all the pieces to do something like that. But it seemed like such a fun thing if you could look at a computer and go, man, I know this thing from the ones and zeros. I built this from the ground up. So he seemed enthused about that. So it's one of the things I'm going to try and keep on our radar. And I think that's it for me.
And quite a one it is. So, Paul, anything happening out in your side of the world?
Yeah, I was trying to think, if there's anything that I sort of have got or haven't mentioned or whatever. But everything's so busy in the academic world. I mean, I guess I set up my Mac on the network, but I talked about that already. So nothing else. I at some point I would also like to get into FPGA programming a bit, but I have many, many projects for the summer.
Yeah. Well, one thing I'd like to mention is that there's going to be a Apple II meetup here in Sydney on the 29th of April. It's already been mentioned both in the RCR podcast Facebook group and the Apple II Enthusiast Facebook group. But if there's anyone who's not in one of those, why aren't you in the RCR podcast group? drop me an email at feedback@rcrpodcast.com and I'll arrange for you to get the details and you can join us. So there's about a dozen of us having a meetup, and no real fixed agenda, but come along, meet us, bring a machine, bring a peripheral. So It'll be a good evening. So it's an evening session on the 29th of April. That's pretty much all I've really got planned going on at the moment. So that looks like we have a wrap for the show. You can find our show notes and for all RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can also discuss us over at the Vintage Computer Federation forums. You can follow us on Twitter at @rcrpodcast. And as I said, you can join our Facebook group, look for RCR Podcast, and send a join invitation, and I'll get that approved pretty quick for you. We are also members of the Throwback Network. You'll find us and other interesting retro-themed podcasts over there. And of course, if you could drop into iTunes and give us a review, that will help other people find us on iTunes and will bring us up in the visibility, and it always helps others if you can just sort of help us. So folks, until next time,
Retro Compute.
What?